Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by Starseed Gem Studios, and they can be found on the web at www.starseedgems.com. Tonight's guest is Chris Carter, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. And good evening to you, Bob.
And a cold good evening to you.
Oh, frigid.
I don't know what part of the world our listeners are in, but where we are, it's 7 degrees tonight. So that's a cold, as cold as it's been for a while. Took out an article that was in our paper a few days ago, and it was an interview with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Struck my eye. Much of the article was interesting. It was about his views on the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and also, you know, the Warren Report, and also some insight into his father. And
just for our younger listeners, John F. Kennedy was Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s uncle.
Right. Because Robert F. Kennedy and John Kennedy were brothers.
Right.
And what I was interested in was Robert F. Kennedy talking about how his father dealt with the death of his brother. And he writes, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said his father spent a year trying to come to grips with his brother's death. He was reading the work of Greek philosophers, Catholic scholars, Henry David Thoreau, poets, and others, trying to figure out kind of the existential implications of why a just God would allow injustice to happen of the magnitude that he was seeing. And, you know, it just struck me, because it doesn't matter what walk of life you're in, you know, a politician, a celebrity, when hit with sudden tragedy of somebody very, very close to you, that is the trigger that starts the search. And I know that we talk about this often, but, you know, if you think back to our own experiences and maybe the experiences of many of our listeners, I would venture to guess that if they have suffered a loss of a close loved one, that completely changed their outlook and started their own search. And then I started thinking that how do we measure change? We're always talking about this paradigm shift and a shift of consciousness and this greater awareness of the afterlife and spiritual awareness. And we'll know that that's working when people who haven't suffered the loss of a close loved one become interested in the evidence and learn of it. I mean, I think back.
There are plenty of people, though, that...
Did you, 10 years ago, did you know what a near-death experience was?
No, I had not a clue.
Neither did I. I mean, if you mentioned the afterlife, I certainly would be questioning whether it existed or not. If you talked to me about telepathy, I would have said that it doesn't exist and it's a magician's trick. If you talked about mediumship, I probably would have said it's a bunch of quacks and people looking to take your money. So that I just use that as an example in my own case of this tremendous shift that took place because of my own investigation and of learning about the evidence. So, you were in a little bit different position, you know, than I was, and perhaps you've thought about more of these things. But I find, and that's the problem that we have with a lot of mainstream scientists and even people in the general public, and it's why, sometimes we get criticized and judged, is that these things are so foreign to them, and people fear what they don't know.
Well, that's true, but there, first of all, I just want to make the point that there are plenty of people out there, and we know that just from our membership rosters, that have not been struck by a tragedy and are on this mission of trying to find out if there's an afterlife or what the unseen world is like. There are also a lot of, and I'm going to put myself into that group, us, who, without having been exposed to a tragedy, without having any kind of stimulus to go after looking for answers of an unseen world, have had sufficient experiences through our childhood that just seemed normal. So there was no reason to go looking for anything. Everything was okay, you know, and going through grade school and them not teaching us about an unseen world was not an unusual thing. They were teaching us about the stuff that did make sense. So there was nothing to trigger anything, any kind of a red flag telling us that anything's wrong with the world. It's all normal. It's all good. And then somebody who's had those experiences then has a tragedy, it seems to make things fall into place. Like there's less searching than somebody like you who hadn't had any childhood experiences or any inner knowing, so you had to search.
You know, I do remember just in going to school and learning about, you know, history, having that inner battle, for instance, when you learn about the Holocaust, trying to imagine how, as they said in the article, as Robert Kennedy Jr. said, his father thought, you know, how a just God could allow such injustice, you know, and that's something that continues today with many, many people. I have a completely different view than then. You know, my reaction then was that there wasn't a God, you know, because that didn't make any sense to me. And of course, now, you know, thinking in a more spiritual sense, you know, I can understand, that a universal creator can exist and there still be evil and injustice in the world. But I do think you raised a good point that maybe you were better prepared, you know, than I was, and maybe some people were better prepared. And that, we can talk in terms of the afterlife that way. Maybe learning about all these things and being open to all these things will ease our path, you know, when it's our time to cross
over.
Well,
things would make more sense. I mean, if you just let's just take it down to the simple nothing, okay? If we were all brought up on the same formula that made us understand that this physical world is just a blip, that there's no pain when you cross over, that you're coming here for a purpose, that you're still going to be living when you leave, you're just not taking the physical body that you incarnated into along with you. Wow, wouldn't that make the end of life so much more acceptable if we knew this?
Yeah, and I'm just thinking it even in more practical terms. If I cross over and I believe now in the physical that I do survive my physical death, it's not going to be a shock. Maybe I'll have less of a period of adjustment when in this other realm because I'm better prepared.
It's true.
Well, let's take a break and bring on our guest. So when we come back from the break, we're going to have our guest Chris Carter. Fascinating talk. We'll be talking about science and the afterlife experience. Mm-hmm. Stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Winbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Winbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.winbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is ATRANSC.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Tuning in, our guest tonight is Chris Carter. Our sponsor is Star Seed Gems Studio, and they can be found on the web at www.starseedgems.com. Bob?
And Chris Carter received his undergraduate and master's degrees in economics and philosophy from the University of Oxford. He's originally from Canada. He now teaches internationally. His current book is Science and the Afterlife Experience, which is part of a trilogy with his previous two books, Science and the Near-Death Experience and Science and Psychic Phenomena. Welcome back, Chris.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm very good. And as I mentioned, you did finish this trilogy. I enjoyed this latest book, Science and the Afterlife Experience. I know you've done a tremendous amount of research in the area of evidence of survival, but it also appears you've devoted an equal amount of time examining the skeptical arguments. So, you know, why do you feel that it's so important to become well-versed in the counter-arguments?
Well, my first book was titled Science and Psychic Phenomena. It opened up the trilogy, and it essentially was trying to understand or trying to answer the question, why has there been a substantial minority of the scientific community that has been denying the existence of psychic abilities for well over a century. And at first glance, this should seem puzzling because surveys show that most scientists accept the reality of psychic phenomena. For example, there was two surveys of over 500 scientists in one case and over 1,000 in another that were made in the 1970s. And both surveys found that a majority of respondents considered extrasensory perception either an established fact or a likely possibility. It was 56% in one survey and 67% in the other. So it was hard for me to understand. I was trying to understand why there was a substantial minority in the scientific community who were devoted to denying that there's any evidence for these claims. So that's what I was trying to answer in my first book. The other reason why I deal with – there's basically two reasons why I deal with so intensely with the skeptical arguments. One reason is the one I just mentioned, trying to answer that puzzle. What is the motivation of these people? And the second reason is, of course, is because if you're trying to establish the truth of some claim or proposition, one of the best ways to go about doing it is to examine all the counterarguments and see if they stand up to careful and critical scrutiny.
And you do that very well in all three books, and it makes for interesting reading and learning, because people should not just jump wholeheartedly on any bandwagon without recognizing what are the possible counterarguments, which makes the evidence that much stronger. Were you surprised when you got into this that when you looked at a lot of the outspoken skeptics of psychic phenomena that they were not like mainstream physicists or scientists, but psychologists?
Yeah, that's true. Most of the modern critics do tend to be psychologists and to a lesser extent biologists. For example, in those surveys that I just mentioned, in one of them, 53% of the ESP is an impossibility responses came from psychologists, even though psychologists made up only 6% of the total sample. And only 3% of natural scientists, that is physicists, chemists, biologists, only 3% of them considered extrasensory perception an impossibility compared to 34% of the psychologists. And, you know, many physicists have gone on record as saying that – well, let me backtrack a little bit. If you ask the psychologists, the skeptical psychologists, why they don't accept the reality of extrasensory perception, they will say things such as, well, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and if these abilities were real, then they would turn the laws of physics upside down. But it's the psychologists, the biologists that are saying that. The physicists are not saying that because they know better. Several physicists, such as David Bohm, Henri Margeneaux, Olivier Costa de Beauregard, the Nobel Prize winner Brian Josephson, have gone on record repeatedly as saying that absolutely nothing in modern physics would be compromised by the existence of psychic abilities such as telepathy. And de Beauregard goes even further and says that modern quantum mechanics virtually demands the existence of psychic abilities such as telepathy. So you have to remember that most of these people are psychologists and philosophers, and their opinions are based upon classical physics, which has been known to be obsolete for well over a century. There's absolutely nothing in modern physics, which is quantum mechanics, which would be contradicted or compromised by the existence of these abilities.
There are a lot of people that are interested in the afterlife. They don't know much about the science. And when you talk about things such as, telepathy and remote viewing and things of that nature, they say, well, why is it important that we learn about this? And what does it have to do with survival? And what does it have to do with the afterlife? So, you know, why is it important to study the relationship between the mind and the brain?
Well, because one of the doctrines of the skeptics, or the phony skeptics as I call them, is the ancient doctrine of materialism. This goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks, and essentially it states that all events have a physical cause. So in other words, all that really matters is matter, and that the brain therefore produces the mind. And the mind is at most merely a byproduct of the brain, a useless byproduct of the brain. It's called, the term is an epiphenomena, that is a phenomenon that can be influenced or produces, can be influenced or produced, but doesn't actually exert any causal effect. The same way that a steam kettle produces a whistle. The boiling water produces the whistle, but the whistle doesn't influence the water in any way. It's an epiphenomena.
Right.
So that's the ancient doctrine of materialism, and it was just considered a philosophical doctrine until shortly after Isaac Newton invented classical physics. And although Isaac Newton rejected the idea himself, certain propagandists of humanism, such as Voltaire and Diderot, the French philosophers, they were using classical mechanics to promote and restore the old philosophical doctrine of materialism. Basically, they were interested in combating religious fanaticism and superstition, which caused so much trouble in their times during the medieval and late medieval period. So essentially, they were using the physics of Isaac Newton for propaganda purposes, although Newton had rejected this himself. Newton himself was a dualist. He was a deeply religious man who believed in survival, incidentally. So I think that it's – so according to the doctrine of materialism, the brain produces the mind. But I honestly think that materialism as a scientific hypothesis has been refuted. Because as a scientific hypothesis, it makes two bold and admirable predictions. First of all, psychic abilities such as telepathy will not exist. And secondly, we'll find no good evidence for a genuine separation of the mind from the body. But as I've shown in my first two books, Science and Psychic Phenomena and Science and the Near-Death Experience, both of these predictions have been proven false by the data. So I think that the evidence indicates that the actual relationship between the mind and the brain is that the brain works as a two-way receiver-transmitter, sometimes from body to mind, as in sense perception, and other times from mind to body, as in willed action. Now, the rival hypothesis that the brain produces the mind has been proven false by the data. And what many people don't realize is that there's a lot of evidence to this effect. And I examined a great deal of this evidence in my book Science and the Near-Death Experience, and my current book, Science and the Afterlife.
So, essentially, I mean, if you believe that your mind can act independently of your brain, that sort of paves the way for the survival hypothesis. I mean, if you no longer have a physical brain, it doesn't necessarily mean that your consciousness does not exist.
That's right.
So I guess that's why it's important as well. One of the areas that you studied in this book, you focused on, this book, The Science and the Afterlife Experience, you focused on different types, three different types of evidence, reincarnation, apparitions. And when we talk about reincarnation, a lot of people are under the impression that there's a long period of time that elapses between, you know, the death of one person and then the subsequent rebirth into the physical. I mean, before I started reading your books and others, I always thought that, you know, you were talking about decades in our time. But the research doesn't show this, does it?
No. Psychiatrist Ian Stevenson, he is probably the one person most responsible for bringing reincarnation to the attention of the modern world. And he intensively studied children who remember previous lives. And he did some calculations, and he found that the interval between the previous personality's death and the subject's birth is usually less than 3 years. The median interval is usually – he found the median interval was about 15 months, although sometimes it can vary from a few hours to more than 20 years.
I think it was Haraldson's work, a lot of his research show that if somebody died in a violent manner, that it might result in a quicker reincarnation?
Yeah, absolutely. there are several features of reincarnation cases that occur universally. And one of them is that the proportion of previous personalities who died violent deaths greatly exceeds the incidence of violent death in that culture.
Mm.
There seems to be a sense of
there
seems to be a sense of unfinished business about the previous personality's life.
Mm. What are your views on karma? I mean, do you believe that, you know, how we conduct ourselves in one life influences the next incarnation?
That's hard to say. Stevenson himself looked at this question. He didn't find a great deal of evidence for karma. He found occasionally individuals did think that they were being punished in their current life for something they did in a previous life. For example, one child remembered a life as a wealthy young man. He basically squandered his family's fortunes. At one point, he boasted about killing a man who he had found coming out of his girlfriend's apartment. And he was reborn in a poor family. And one could say, well, this was a fraudulent case because, you know, their family was trying to get money from the previous personality's family. But it's not true. As I said before, he had squandered the family fortune, leaving them almost destitute. So there wasn't money to be gained from this. But he eventually began to show remorse for the killing that he said he committed in a previous life, and thought that he was somehow making amends for that in his current life. And he became a very different sort of person than he apparently was in the previous life. But apart from that, Stevenson hasn't found a great deal of evidence for the sort of karma that most people think. That is, you know, if you've been a good person in one life, you're reborn into a wealthy family. Because he's found cases in which people, the previous personality was in a poorer family or harder circumstances than the current one, and vice versa, of course. Mm. In most cases, it's about the same. Having said that, Stevenson thinks that there's evidence of influence in the sense of personal growth. For instance, someone who was very greedy and selfish in a previous life may eventually come in another life to be a more generous and kind person. So there seems to be evidence of growth, but not evidence of karma in the crude sense of retribution or retaliation.
What about people who say that, you know, these children, these cases of past life memories are simply the result of a child receiving information, you know, telepathically or clairvoyantly? I mean, how do you answer that?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of problems with that, actually. I mean, first of all, extrasensory perception cannot explain why subjects have difficulty recognizing persons or places that have changed since the death of the previous personality. For example, they don't recognize buildings that were recently put up or painted since the death of the previous personality. So that's one problem with it. And another thing is that information acquired telepathically or clairvoyantly is not typically experienced as something remembered. And a lot of these kids predictably make virtually no errors, whereas most telepaths make a predictable number of mistakes. The ESP hypothesis would also predict that we would occasionally find more than one child claiming to remember life of a certain deceased person, but we don't. There's absolutely no cases like that on record. And we also have to remember that apart from these memories of previous lives, these children typically display absolutely no evidence of extraordinary powers of extrasensory perception. So why should their powers of extrasensory perception be restricted entirely to the memories of one deceased person whom they never even met? And also, extrasensory perception may explain the acquisition of knowledge, but it can't explain the acquisition of skills requiring a great deal of practice. In other words, we can use perception to know that something is true, but we can't use perception to understand knowing how to do something. But some of these children have spoken, used words that they don't understand, use words from foreign language. They've performed. There was one girl who performed complicated dances and sang a song in a language that she didn't understand, or which the previous personality did, and playing musical instruments and so forth. So extrasensory perception cannot explain the display of skills which the child has not acquired.
Certainly good arguments. I had, let's pivot to another area that you've researched in this book, and that's apparitions. So immediately when you talk about apparitions, or ghosts, a lot of people will immediately say, or critics will say, that their apparitions are nothing more than hallucinations. So how do you respond to that?
Well, there's a number of problems with hallucination theory. One problem is that these apparitions are sometimes perceived by more than one person at the same time, or by, more commonly, by several different people at different times. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever for collective hallucinations, apart from one or two extraordinary cases during wartime in which sailors had their ship sunk, and they were trapped on on lifeboats for weeks on end, and they were, of course, dying from thirst and from starvation. And sometimes these desperate men did hallucinate ships coming to rescue them in the back, in the distance, and that sort of thing. And it seems like, and through the power of suggestion, these hallucinations sometimes spread to others of these desperate men dying of thirst and starvation. That was the only example that I could find of any sort of collective hallucination. And that bears absolutely no relationship between people who've reported collectively perceived apparitions. It also can't explain cases in which animals have reacted to apparitions. It also can't explain cases in which people have seen the apparitions of someone who they didn't even know, who they later identified from a photograph. So there's a lot of problems with the hallucination model as an explanation for apparitions.
And as despite what people may believe because of the media that they see or read, apparitions don't only appear in dark conditions, and they're not always viewed as some nebulous, cloudy sort of a vision, right? I mean, apparitions, the research shows that they sometimes appear in perfect condition, and they're seen. The people actually think that they're seeing people in the physical, right?
That's right. They normally appear. Real and solid, and so much they're frequently mistaken for actual living people. Let's see here if I can see any figures. Let's see. There's one study that was done that stated only 46% of the sample realized immediately they were experiencing an apparition. 18% realized this before the experience ended, 6% as it ended, and 31% only after it ended. So in other words, only over half of the people who reported an apparition did not immediately distinguish the apparition from a living person. And nearly a third thought they were seeing an ordinary person throughout the entire experience. And there's several reasons for this perceived realism. Apparitions may cast a shadow, they may be reflected in the mirror, and they typically show awareness of their surroundings, such as avoiding furniture and people, or turning to follow a person's movement. And some of them are reported to speak, although that's not common. If they do speak, there's usually only a few words.
Well, I'd like to continue this conversation about apparitions after the break and get into some of the messages from other realms. So stay with us, and we'll be back with Chris Carter in a few minutes.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you are just tuning in, our guest tonight is Chris Carter. This show is sponsored by Starseed Gems Studios, and they can be found on the web at www.starseedgems.com. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to our show, we have a few important foundation updates for our listeners. We'd like to recognize our 2012 benefactors and patrons. We have Frank and Arlene McGonigal, Kathleen Murray, Arthur Perkins, Anonymous, Angelina Diana, and Anonymous with funds dedicated for the VISTA project. We thank everybody for their support in 2012, and we look forward to everybody's continued support in 2013. Now, there are three ways you can show us that you like Signs of Life Radio. First, you can go to Signs of Life Radio page on Facebook and you can like us. Or two, you can use the donate button on any of our weekly email show reminders to support programming. There's also a space to add a comment on what you love and what you don't like so much about the show. And three, remember us when you go shopping. Yes, when you shop, you can support the work of our 100% volunteer not-for-profit organization without spending any additional money at all. First, you'll need a credit card to shop online. So if you don't already have one or are in need of another, go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that's taken out, and each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. Second, if your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com. But first, use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website, and again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we receive a donation. And when you find what you are looking for in their more than 1,000 online stores like Lord & Taylor, Nike, Nordstrom, Petco, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. Our upcoming events include Dessert and Discarnates. We thank Angelina Diana. That event is filled, and it will take place on February 15th. We also have coming up Night of Mediums on April 12, 2013 at the Melville Marriott, with lots of mediums coming from across the country to take part in this once-a-year fundraiser. And then coming up on the weekend of July 26th through 28th, we have our Grief Transformation Weekend. So watch for those events on our website. And we're back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Chris Carter, author of Science and the Afterlife Experience, which is completes a trilogy of with his previous two books, Science and a Near-Death Experience and Science and Psychic Phenomena. Chris, we left off talking about apparitions. Some of the cases are very evidential where an apparition gives information to a person in the physical, information that wasn't known by the person at that time but found out later to be true. And you give a good example of that with one case that I recall, the Chaffin Will case. Can you give us a couple of highlights of that?
Sure. The case involved the contested will of James L. Chaffin. He was a farmer in Dave County, North Carolina, and it's an unusual case in several respects, and because it's been unusually well authenticated, because all the facts were carefully scrutinized in a court of justice in 1925 in the case of Chaffin v. Chaffin. Anyway, in 1905, James L. Chaffin made out a will, duly attested by two witnesses, and whereby he gave his property to his third son, Marshall. And to his widow and his other three sons, he left nothing. And then, September, years later, he died suddenly as a result of a fall, and his son Marshall duly took ownership of Mr. Chaffin's farm and other possessions. And his widow and his three other sons did not contest the will, and they had no valid reason for doing so. But 4 years later, June 1925, the second son, James Chaffin, began to have very vivid dreams in which his father appeared at his bedside without saying anything. And later that month, it was either in a dream or in a state between waking and sleeping. James himself wasn't sure. But James testified, "He appeared at my bedside again, dressed as I had often seen him dressed in life, wearing a black overcoat, which I knew to be his own coat. This time my father's spirit spoke to me, and he took hold of his overcoat this way and pulled it back and said, 'You will find my will in my overcoat pocket,' and then disappeared." So James was convinced that his father had visited him and visited his mother the following day looking for the overcoat. They found it. No, I'm sorry. The coat had been given to his brother John. So the following Monday he traveled 20 miles to his brother's house and found the coat and found that the inside pocket of the old coat had been sewn shut. So they cut the threads, and a roll of paper was found with a message in their father's handwriting. And the message said, "Read the 27th chapter of Genesis in my daddy's old Bible." So it wasn't the will, it was a message to look up the 27th chapter of Genesis in his father's old Bible. So at this point, Chaffin recruited two neighbors and his daughter as witnesses, and then traveled back to his mother's home to examine the old family Bible. So they searched all over for it. They eventually found it. It was dilapidated and broken in three pieces. And the neighbor, one Mr. Blackwelder, picked up the section that contained the book of Genesis and turned to the 27th chapter. And there, within the folded pages, he found the second will of the deceased Elder James Chaffin. And it read as follows. "After reading the 27th chapter of Genesis, I, James L. Chaffin, do make my last will and testament, and here it is. I want, after giving my body a decent burial, my little property to be equally divided between my four children, if they are living at my death, both personal and real estate divided equally, if not living, give share to their children. And if she is living, you must all take care of your mammy. Now this is my last will and testament. Witness my hand and seal, James L. Chaffin, January 16, 1919. In other words, 2 years before his death. So the 27th chapter of Genesis tells how the younger brother Jacob supplanted his older brother Esau and won his birthright. And the sole beneficiary of the first will, you remembered, was the youngest brother Marshall. Now Marshall had died within a year of his father's death, leaving a son to inherit the family's property, according to the first will. Now, when the second will was tendered in court, Marshall's son and his widow contested the document with a lawsuit. So in December 20, 1925, a jury was sworn in, and a crowd packed the courtroom, hoping to witness a spectacle of a bitter family feud fought out in public. So anyway, during lunch, when the case was adjourned, one of the lawyers announced that during the interval, an agreement had been reached, and that the new will would now be admitted without opposition by Marshall's son and his widow. So, during the lunch interval, they had been shown the document, in other words, the second will from 1919. And 10 witnesses were prepared to testify that the second will was in the deceased Chaffin's handwriting. And his widow and son admitted this as soon as they saw it. So their opposition was withdrawn at once. And that was the end of the case.
Message sure was received.
Yeah, the case was it's an unusually well-researched and well-documented case. So yeah. Not only were the facts put in evidence in a contested lawsuit, but there was an attorney named James J. Johnson who researched this case on behalf of the American Society for Psychical Research. And so he went down to North Carolina. He took sworn statements from both sides of the family. He studied the original documents of the court. He took copies and took them to the American Society of Psychical Research. And the case seems solid.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful piece of evidence. Before we run out of time, maybe we can take a call. Franny,
right. We have Jean holding from Florida.
Hello, Jean. Jean.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
How are you, Bob and Fran?
Good.
Hello.
You're on with Chris Carter. Did you have a question for Chris?
Yes. I was wondering if he was doing readings. If not, I'd like to ask a question.
Well, I don't do readings. I don't do readings,
Chris.
Jean
is not a medium.
Chris is a
Okay. All right. Then let me ask a question.
Cool.
Of Chris. Okay.
Sure.
Is it possible to change your Akashic records?
Huh. Well, I guess it depends what you mean by change them. You mean add to them? Absolutely. Change what's already there? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. I'm calling in regard to a health problem that my daughter has and was told that she changed her Akashic records. And I was just wondering if she was going to be okay. And what the soul's purpose was for her charting this in the chart and now having this series of health problems that she's had in taking a holistic course with it.
Well, you're probably asking the wrong guy because I'm not a medium, but from everything that I've read, obviously you can't change the past, but you can make amends for things that that we've done. Everyone's capable of changing their lives and setting their lives on a new and better course.
I see. Okay.
Well, thanks for calling, and perhaps you want to call in during the Mediums and Messages show. You might get some more insight into that.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Take care. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Chris, you've certainly examined so much evidence in all three of your books. The latest one is devoted to evidence of an afterlife. Have you come to any conclusion, in your opinion, what sort of evidence for survival is the strongest?
Yeah. In my books, I cover evidence from five very different lines of evidence, from near-death experiences, deathbed visions, apparitions, children who remember previous lives, and alleged communication from the deceased via talented human mediums. I'd have to say the single most impressive line of evidence supporting survival comes from the latter, that is, communication from the deceased via human mediums. There's several reasons for this. First of all, the level of detailed information, the best communications, is simply astonishing. Not just facts unknown to anyone present, which are later verified, but also in the best cases, the communication is from the perspective of the deceased, displays aspects of their personality which are recognized by surviving friends and relatives, and in their most remarkable cases, high-level skills are demonstrated, skills which the medium does not possess, but which required the deceased person communicating, required years of practice to acquire. And the other reason is that in the best cases of mediumship, everything the medium says or writes is recorded. So in other words, the records are permanent and objective and can be studied and analyzed by anyone at any time. This is unlike the other lines of evidence. So in terms of communication from mediums, the question of mistaken eyewitness testimony simply does not arise.
Well, we could certainly do a whole show on that, and I wish we had more time. I would encourage anybody who is seeking evidence to pick up all three of Chris's books, Science and the Afterlife Experience, Science and the Near-Death Experience, and Science and Psychic Phenomena, The Fall of the House of Skeptics. Just about every bit of research along these lines has been delved into with both sides, the arguments, the counter-arguments, and you'll get a much clearer picture of the universe and your role in it. Chris, I thank you so much. We look forward to your future work, and I know you mentioned possibly some film endeavors, and keep us posted so we can keep our listeners posted. So thanks for joining us.
All right, Bob. Just one other thing. If any of your listeners would like to learn more about my latest book, they can always check out the book's website. So the website is the same as the book. It's www.scienceandtheafterlifeexperience.com. They can look at the table of contents, read excerpts, and read endorsements of my latest book from scientists and philosophers and physicians from around the world.
That's great. That's www.scienceandtheafterlifeexperience.com. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, take care.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Johanna Suchow, Laura Lynn Jackson, Francis Mastracco, Tim Donahue, Deb Martin, Tina Jocelyn, Jerry Deanna, Barbara Russell, Alex, Nancy Scheel, Vicki Steffi, Wendy Lippo, Mark Varon, Eileen Lafata, Rita Springer, David Haith, Barbara Petillo, Glenna Irwin, Chase McKenna, Elizabeth McKenna, Julie B., Stanley Newland, Laura Prisco, Tracy Lee Nash, Marianne Pierschka, Tanya Cash, and Pat Leo Grande. And now please join me in the Global Peace Prayer. Now let us give as one consciousness our energy of loving thought by praying like this. to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And with that all said, it's now time to say...
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.